Chapter 22. Comparing the events following Marilyn Monroe's death with those of Dorothy Kilgallen's demise and even John F. Kennedy's offers several disturbing similarities. The medical examiner's verdict in Marilyn's case was probable suicide, while in Kilgallen's it was the equally ambiguous and misleading words added to the verdict of accidental death, circumstances undetermined. Marilyn's coroner examination, performed as coroner case number 81128 at 10:30 a.m. on August 5, 1962, is packed with as much mystery as was the case when Kilgallen died 3 years later. Amazingly enough, as will be shown in Kilgallen's case, Marilyn was examined by a deputy/junior medical examiner, one with less experience and expertise than the chief medical examiner. One must question why this happened, leading to speculation that those in charge of examining the two deaths wanted only the appearance of an autopsy rather than a genuine and thorough autopsy. In Marilyn's case, three words in the official copy of the autopsy report, dated August 5, 1962, bear mention. Notice them just under the first paragraph. Acute barbiturate poisoning, ingestion of overdose. While there is no way to confirm exactly why the words poisoning and then ingestion of overdose were used, the former perhaps indicating foul play and the latter accidental death due to overdose, what is apparent is the absence of any indication that Marilyn committed suicide. One reaction to the wording is that whoever performed the autopsy either suspected foul play or, in the alternative, accidental death due to an overdose but never suicide. The man who filled in this document, and thus Marilyn's safekeeper as to the truth about what happened to her in the forensic sense, was Dr. Thomas Noguchi. Many accounts of a forensic nature have been offered through the years, but in 2009, Dr. Noguchi, 82 at the time, presented his version in a widely circulated, illuminating, and, if true, disturbing interview with a Los Angeles Examiner reporter. Noguchi's conduct attracts suspicion from the outset in having told the journalist he had no idea who Marilyn Monroe was. I just assumed it was someone else who had the same name. Difficult to believe, for sure, since that name was famous throughout the world, but nevertheless, Noguchi stated that he had examined a woman who was 5 feet 4 inches tall, weighing just over 10 stone, 140 pounds. He added that the police report included the fact that various bottles of pills, including an empty bottle of Nembutal, were scattered close to the body. Noguchi said he began the autopsy by inspecting Marilyn's body for needle marks, in case she had been injected for drugs, and for marks indicating physical violence. The coroner stated that he found no needle marks. Did he check under Marilyn's armpits, her toes, but did discover a dark reddish-blue bruise on her left hip, one, judging by its color, fresh rather than old. No explanation was ever given as to the possible cause of the bruise. Surprisingly, Noguchi said his internal examination produced no visual evidence of any pills in Marilyn's stomach. Since he was aware of the empty Nembutal bottle, he checked for a yellowish dye with which Nembutal capsules were coated in her stomach, but found none. A step up from Seconal on the ladder of dangerous barbiturates, Nembutal has been called yellow birds or yellow jackets when marketed on the street as yellow capsules. The drug consists of white, odorless, crystalline granules or a white powder with a slightly bitter taste. It is very soluble in water or alcohol. The latter accelerates its effect above the normal 40-minute range, similar to Seconal. Normal digestion of either Nembutal or chloral hydrate, which acts as a depressant on the central nervous system with sedative effects similar to those of barbiturates, normally requires water intake, and if Marilyn had consumed close to 50 pills, as was speculated, perhaps several glasses of water, it seems likely, would have been necessary to absorb that intake. When reading Dr. Noguchi's report, Kilgallen, whose own autopsy would reveal traces of Nembutal, as will be explained, would have questioned why no drinking glass or glasses appeared in the crime scene photographs. Thomas Noguchi did discover a milky substance in Marilyn's stomach, but again, he provided no explanation in his coroner's report. In addition to blood samples forwarded for toxicological testing, he sent Marilyn's internal organs as well. Noguchi said that several hours after he had completed the autopsy, the results came back, indicating 8% level of chloral hydrate in the blood, while the liver tests revealed 13% of pentobarbital, Nembutal. Each dose alone would have been fatal. This testing may be assumed to be competent, but then Noguchi dropped a blockbuster during his interview, admitting he made a mistake at this point since the toxicology tests had only been performed on the blood and the liver, not on the internal organs. He added that he should have insisted that all of the organs be examined. Noguchi was certainly correct when he admitted that if he had done his job right and examined all of the organs, as was standard procedure, I am sure that this could have cleared up a lot of the subsequent controversy, but I didn't follow through as I should have. Noguchi then made a second mistake, one he later admitted, when he had given his boss, Dr. Theodore Kerfey, what turned out to be an incomplete autopsy. Based on that report, which included no mention of any suicide having occurred, Kerfey nonetheless announced to the public that Marilyn had died of a probable suicide via the certificate of death, which, for the first time, included the words probable suicide as the cause of Marilyn's demise. Whether Kerfey did this on purpose will be considered. The result was that this less-than-truthful conclusion spread quickly to the world, with headlines such as Marilyn Monroe Kills Self, since the media failed to print the probable side of the findings, and instead just intimated that she had committed suicide. This was a sensationalist conclusion, just as erroneous as when Kilgallen's cause of death, 3 years later, was manipulated by the coroner into a self-administered overdose and reported to the public through the media. Dr. Noguchi said in his interview that while he agreed with the probable suicide verdict, he also regretted another decision he made. Apparently sufficiently troubled by the oversight of not testing all of Marilyn's organs, he went back to the toxicology lab a few weeks later and asked if they could test the other organs he had sent over. By then it was too late, he was told, since the organs had already been disposed of as the case had been marked as closed. Summing up, Noguchi stated, "I think it was a great shame, not suspicious. I'm not saying that. It was a perfectly normal procedure, but still a shame." A rather confusing assembly of words accomplishing little more than confirming his incompetence. In later years, the autopsy would be hounded with criticism, including by famed author Norman Mailer, who told the Los Angeles Examiner, "The word was out to keep this thing a suicide, not make it a murder." As time passed, Noguchi would take on a reputation as the coroner of the stars, with a flair for the sensational, before controversial disclosures about the deaths of actor William Holden and actress Natalie Wood led to his downfall. He was also accused of mismanagement, using the office to promote his personal projects, and accused of indiscretion regarding the autopsies performed. The fighting coroner, as he had come to be known, was banished to County USC Medical Center as a pathologist and teacher. To his credit, Noguchi, on two occasions, called for Marilyn's case to be reopened. Regarding the absence of pills in her stomach, he said that, "As a habitual pill user, she would have no problem digesting both the Nembutal and the chloral hydrate, and they would have been pumped straight through to the intestine. But since the intestines were never examined, this conclusion cannot be proven. As for the yellow color of the Nembutal pills not being evident in her stomach, Noguchi said that the dye doesn't run when it is swallowed." Noguchi also noted the absence of a suicide note, and admitted where Marilyn had died was no typical suicide scene. He did not elaborate on either comment, but did add, "The case is a giant jigsaw puzzle, 100 pieces, 12 pieces missing." In fact, Sergeant Jack Clemens of the LAPD, the first officer on the scene, in various interviews over the years, questioned the time between when Marilyn's body was discovered and the call to the police, some 4 to 5 hours, wondering whether any vomit may have been cleaned up before he arrived. He observed, "Someone can't swallow that many barbiturates without throwing up. Therefore, she could have only gotten drugs in her body by another method." This conclusion led to the possibility that the drugs were provided through a suppository or administered in an enema. That potential was increased by the fact that the lower part of Marilyn's colon, according to the autopsy, showed purplish discoloration, indicating that an enema could have been utilized, destroying any possibility that Marilyn ingested the barbiturates by mouth. Whether Noguchi ever considered this possibility is unknown, but no question appears to exist that the initial conclusion she died of an acute barbiturate poisoning ingestion of overdose became probable suicide as the cause of death before bouncing to suicide in the media. This was quite suspicious in nature, but, as will be seen, highly predictable by those who were determined to cover up the real truth about Marilyn Monroe's death. The medical examiner's verdict must be evaluated based on what Gianni Russo wrote in his book Hollywood Godfather and told this author during a 2020 interview. The information, as noted, stems from his having been at the Cal Neva Resort just a week before Marilyn died, where he had been in the company of Frank Sinatra, John and Robert Kennedy, Sam Giancana, and others of note, as confirmed by famous drummer Buddy Greco. Russo had written in his book that Marilyn, after being quite upset that she was being set up to have sex with the Kennedy brothers, sex that would be secretly recorded, telephoned Joe DiMaggio and asked him to come get her, but he refused to do so after being threatened by Frank Sinatra. Before she left, Marilyn, Russo had written, said she was going to the press to tell them what the Kennedys were really like. Russo then recalled to this author a fresh take on what happened. Marilyn shouldn't have mentioned going to the media because within 3 days she was dead, echoing what was written in his book. This account by Russo remained consistent with his beliefs as to how Marilyn died. First, Russo, formerly Marilyn's friend and lover, wrote that he didn't think the mob had anything to do with her death, since the mob bosses loved Marilyn, and if anyone came close to treating her well, it was the mob, despite the planned Cal Neva filming escapade. Instead, Russo squarely pointed the finger of blame for her death at the Kennedys, whom he said had come across to an adoring public as the personification of the great American dynasty, but that Marilyn knew better and wanted them exposed for the disingenuous, poor excuses for human beings that they were. Regarding further details of Marilyn's demise, Russo wrote, "According to my mob sources, Marilyn was given an injection of air through her pubic area, hiding the needle mark, and directly into a vein by a doctor on orders from Bobby Kennedy, who viewed Marilyn as a loose cannon." Russo added, "The injection of air caused an embolism and she died." Summing up, Russo wrote, "Knowing the Kennedys and their duplicity, I believe the story of Bobby Kennedy's involvement in Marilyn's death, as told to me by reliable sources. If true, and Russo was certainly in a position to know the truth, his account substantiates a possible conclusion that Marilyn was murdered due to an injection of air. The injection having taken place in what is presumed to be the hair around the pubic area, which Noguchi may not have examined, may account for his discovering no needle marks during the autopsy. Regardless, Russo's account makes good sense as to how Marilyn was murdered in order to silence her forever." In April 2020, this author was contacted by respected Los Angeles businessman Dwight Manley after he had viewed on YouTube this author's November 2019 presentation at the Allen Library in Dallas regarding denial of justice. Primary source information in the video about Kilgallen's mysterious death had piqued Manley's renewed interest in Marilyn's mysterious death based on accounts provided to him years earlier. Manley's source about the famous actress's death was Joe DiCarlo. According to an extensive Los Angeles Times obituary issued when he died at 89 years of age in 2016, DiCarlo had been the manager of Sonny and Cher, co-founder of Pips International, the former restaurant, backgammon club, and nightclub in Beverly Hills, confidant and lifelong friend to several Hollywood celebrities, athletes, and notorious figures. The obituary added, "In 1959, Joe was spending more time in Los Angeles managing various nightclub acts and showgirls, including the likes of Candy Bar and Beverly Hills." Joe's relationship to the infamous Mickey Cohen began as a result of Cohen dating these women. This is the same Candy Bar whom Melvin Belli, Jack Ruby's attorney, represented in the appeal of her narcotics conviction in Dallas, a case held before Judge Joe Brown, the judge who handled the Ruby trial. Barr was a top-name stripper who appeared in Las Vegas and also at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. At one point, she was engaged to gangster Mickey Cohen, Belli's client. Barr was convicted by a jury in 1965 and sentenced to 15 years in prison, with Bill Alexander prosecuting. Belli's appeal was denied, and she spent 3 years in prison before Texas Governor John Connally pardoned her. Footage from the University of North Texas archives captures Candy's release. Following Ruby's arrest, the Dallas Morning News reported, "Ruby had given a puppy to Candy Barr, a well-known Dallas stripper who worked a few doors down from Ruby's strip club." The story added, "Within 10 hours after Ruby's shooting of Oswald, the FBI interrogated Candy Barr. The agents asked about her friendship with Ruby and any part in an alleged plot to kill the president. The interrogation lasted several hours." The next day, another Dallas Morning News article read, "Candy Barr, a well-known Dallas stripper who worked a few doors down from Ruby's strip club, told reporters she received a call from Ruby shortly before the JFK assassination. She said Ruby was trying to get in touch with Mickey Cohen or some other mobster. Ruby was certain that Juanita, Candy, would know how." DiCarlo, who was, as the obituary stated, of Sicilian roots, had been acquitted, along with Cohen, of murdering Jack the Enforcer Whalen in a famous L.A. case that the Los Angeles Times wrote about in a series of articles with the headline, "Tales from the Gangster Squad." Among other bits of notoriety, DiCarlo was a poster boy for good looks and a savvy personality who had endeared himself to Sonny and Cher, as well as Playboy founder Hugh Hefner, whom DiCarlo accompanied on the Playboy jet to Europe and Hawaii. According to the Times, DiCarlo was looking for new talent, sightseeing while enjoying life along the way, and was best known for co-founding Pips International, a private restaurant located in Beverly Hills. It featured the backgammon playground as being frequented by Hollywood celebrities and foreign royalty. Among them was famed actress Lucille Ball. DiCarlo's celebrity status extended even to Washington, D.C. With Cher on his arm, DiCarlo dined with President Jimmy Carter in private quarters at the White House in 1977, just after Carter's election. DiCarlo could also boast of knowing Presidents John Kennedy, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan. Dwight Manley knew DiCarlo quite well due to Manley's longtime friendship with Larry Goldberg, another well-known Los Angeles businessman and close friend of DiCarlo's for many years, and one who frequented Pips on a regular basis. Goldberg also was familiar with Frank Sinatra. He's shown with his wife Marilyn in a photo taken at Pips with Frank, Frank's wife Barbara, DiCarlo, and NBA star Elgin Baylor and his wife Ruby. Manley provided a valuable contribution to the events surrounding Marilyn's death. While attending Goldberg's 70th birthday celebration at the prestigious Morton's Restaurant in L.A., he found himself in a banquet back room with DiCarlo and Goldberg. Manley told this author, "I was sitting facing Joe and I had just seen some story or documentary about Bobby Kennedy having an alibi for when Marilyn Monroe died." He added, "Joe was Mickey Cohen's enforcer, at least one of them, and Joe was a tough guy who loved to tell stories. So, with the alibi in mind, I point-blank asked Joe about Marilyn Monroe's death." According to Manley, DiCarlo told him, "The day before Marilyn died, Bobby Kennedy, with Peter Lawford by his side, was picked up in Los Angeles, having traveled from the San Francisco area and then driven to Marilyn Monroe's home, where Kennedy and Lawford pleaded, begged with her to shut up about what she knew about the Kennedys. But Marilyn refused to do so. Joe never wavered or hemmed or hawed when answering my questions about this." Manley then added that Joe said, "They sent people there, had it handled, no needles, anal." Asked for further details, Manley told this author, "I specifically asked him about an enema of drugs, and Joe said yes." Manley's account about what happened to Marilyn appears to square up based on his stellar reputation, and with the added element being he had no reason to lie about what DiCarlo told him, with the mobster's account credible as well. In Russo's case, his account also seems reliable in light of his having known Marilyn for many years and having been privy to what occurred at the Calneva Lodge prior to her death. Accounts of Marilyn having died of an enema full of barbiturates, DiCarlo's explanation, or an injection of air into the pubic area, Russo's claim, gain credence given strong opinions by those who later considered how Marilyn could have possibly ingested nearly 50 pills during the time before she died. This would have had to happen during the time span between when Dr. Greenson left her home in the late afternoon and when she allegedly died a few hours later. Kilgallen may have had real questions about this factual situation if she had studied the toxicological reports, since there was a strong biochemical problem. This was due to the fact that it seemed nearly impossible that Marilyn could have ingested that many Nembutal pills, since she would have died much sooner rather than several hours later. Adding to suspicion of murder being covered up, Marilyn's case was under the jurisdiction of L.A. Police Chief William Parker, a close friend of Robert Kennedy's, and he forwarded the case to the city's new suicide investigation team, which included three psychiatrists, Robert Littman, Norman Farberow, and Norman Tabachnik. Conveniently, this team was charged only with determining why Marilyn committed suicide, excluding the possibility she could have been murdered. Their report stated, "In our investigation, we have learned that Miss Monroe had often expressed wishes to give up, to withdraw, and even to die. On one or more occasion, when disappointed and depressed, she had made a suicide attempt using sedative drugs. On these occasions, she had called for help and been rescued." Such an incomplete and superficial investigation amounts to three shrinks simply using old news to throw Marilyn under the bus. While there had been instances of her calling for help, primary source evidence pointed merely to problems Marilyn had with the dosage she ought to be taking. These psychiatrists certainly did not take into account that Marilyn's life was on an enviable upswing, and that, like Kilgallen, she had everything to live for, despite her problems with the Kennedys. Recall that Marilyn's close friend, Pat Newcomb, said that Marilyn was in a good mood, a very happy mood, the day of her death, the exact opposite of her being in a suicidal mood. Regardless, Parker apparently got the verdict he wanted, or could have been ordered to get, and then 5 days later he shut down any inquiry into her death, officially ruling it a suicide. End of story, at least as far as those attempting to keep secret the details of Marilyn's death were concerned. What must be of prime interest is the question of how Dr. Noguchi, a deputy medical examiner, ended up overseeing the autopsy of Marilyn. At the time of her death, the chief medical examiner in Los Angeles was Dr. Theodore Kerfey, a transplanted New Yorker who had been the coroner of Nassau County, New York from 1938 to 1957. A year after being appointed to head the new ME office in L.A., Kerfey was called curt, rude, tactless, arrogant. Those attitudes, and a series of judicial attacks directed at autopsy reforms he installed, put him at odds with county officials. Controversy concerning his work grew to the point where a grand jury investigation was ordered. But Kerfey kept his job, even though a subsequent dispute with local morticians over delays in issuing death certificates brought more controversy to his table. After Dr. Noguchi's findings, on August 17, 1962, 12 days after Marilyn died, Dr. Kerfey held a news conference in which he stated, "It is my conclusion that the death of Marilyn Monroe was caused by a self-administered overdose of sedative drugs and that the mode of death is probable suicide." Why reporters listening to this account did not question the use of probable to qualify the actual cause of death is reminiscent of the media never questioning circumstances undetermined being included when Kilgallen's death was announced. Shoddy journalism, for sure. When noted forensic scientist Dr. Cyril Wecht was asked about the verdict, he told the Los Angeles Times, "I have conducted more than 16,000 autopsies and seen many others, and I have never seen the word probable with the word suicide used in a report." Dr. Wecht did not elaborate on this statement, but he apparently meant that something seemed unusual about that verdict, that those in charge had doubts about what really happened, a doubt applicable to Kilgallen's case as well. Predictably, no formal inquest or grand jury investigation was ever convened regarding the death. Because the police jumped to the conclusion Marilyn committed suicide, the main investigative agency handling the case was the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office, not the Police Homicide Department. As noted, rather than conduct a public inquest where sworn testimony could be taken, Dr. Kerfey decided to appoint the 3-member team of mental health professionals to probe into Monroe's background and assess what may have happened. That so-called investigation lasted only 11 days, and several key people who might have had knowledge of Monroe's last days were not interviewed. The interviews that were taken were informal and not under oath. For example, Peter Lawford, who had talked to Monroe on the phone only hours before her death, was not interviewed by investigators for the Los Angeles Police Department until 1975. This disturbing error in judgment was similar, as will be revealed, to the failure to interview key persons in the aftermath of Kilgallen's death, such as family members, her butler, or her journalistic colleagues. Dr. Kerfey never divulged why he did not handle Marilyn's autopsy himself, but instead passed it on to Dr. Noguchi. One may only speculate as to whether corruption in the L.A. Medical Examiner's office, with Dr. Kerfey's acquiescence, led to the decision to have Dr. Noguchi handle Marilyn's case. In light of Dr. Noguchi's admitted incompetence, Marilyn deserved a better fate. Regardless, Dr. Kerfey deciding not to convene an inquest and LAPD Chief Parker's closing the case combined to bring a hasty conclusion to any possible search for the truth, that is, until now.